Tonight's Each for All show will involve adult themes. Listener discretion is advised. Good evening, Each for All. I'm your host, Josh Peterman, and on tonight's show, I'm talking to Jack Lehman of Come As You Are, a Toronto-based worker-owned sex shop co-op. We'll be discussing the development of sexual attitudes over the past 20 years, the economic transition happening on Queen Street, and the philosophies behind sexual health. We're going to take a quick musical break, and we'll be back with Jack Lehman from Come As You Are.
Co-op Radio. We are not here to make money, but we do need money. The content's free, but the equipment ain't. Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
I'm speaking today with Jack Lehman of Come As You Are, a Toronto sex-based co-op that aims to promote sexual health, well-being, and education. Hello, Jack.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going good. The weather has finally warmed up a little bit here in Vancouver. How are you?
It's strangely warm here, but it really shouldn't be.
So we'll dive into kind of the history of Come As You Are. You got into the co-op in 2001. Prior to working there, did you know what the co-op was all about? Like, how did you get involved?
I got involved. Well, I had been a customer of the store, but I had no idea that it was a cooperative. And I got involved because I was actually just looking for an interesting gig for maybe a year or so while I decided what I wanted to do next in my life. And I loved it here, and I ended up sticking around. And I think that's sort of typical of folks who work for the co-op. You either leave very quickly or you kind of stay forever. There's not a lot in between.
I could definitely understand that volunteering with Each for All has been a lot like that as well. You kind of put that toe in, and then after you feel the water is warm, you're like, yes, this is awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
Since you've been there for, going on 16 years, what sort of developments have you seen, or what sort of, how's the company sort of evolved over that period of time?
Yeah, it's been a really fascinating 20 years. It's 2017 now, so it's actually Come As You Are Cooperative's 20th anniversary this year, which is pretty amazing that we've actually gotten through 20 whole years of this. You know, I think that things have evolved substantially in so many different directions. I think a couple years after I started at the co-op, you know, we opened the store in Montreal, we closed the store in Montreal. Definitely the internet and our web presence has become more and more of our business over the years. But, you know, I think that the co-op is really fascinating, and that we've gone through, you know, several different incarnations in terms of membership, but also in terms of ideology and our direction. I would say that the time, like the sort of 4 years that happened before I was hired, were really just a sort of finding their feet kind of period. So I'd say that, you know, within about 4 years of the co-op being founded, you know, the store opened, I think that the membership that existed did find a way to make money work generally. That is, we weren't constantly going out of business. And I think that we were founded as a cooperative for a couple of, you know, really co-op-minded reasons, but I think, you know, for some sort of less co-op-minded reasons as well. So when you look at feminist, sex-positive sex shops, especially in North America, they tend to be founded by one person who has a particular sexual ideology. And I think for us, being founded as a co-op was a great way to reflect a variety of sexualities, genders, orientations. And in fact, the more diverse our co-op is, the more we're better able to serve the customers that we serve. We don't make a lot of assumptions about the people who access our products and services. It's really, really hard to get away from extrapolating from one's own personal sexual experience, you know, onto other people. And as a co-op, we were never tempted to do that because we always reflected a diverse, you know, set of experiences and ideologies and genders and orientations. In fact, we were founded by a majority of people who were either trans or gender variant identified, which is super unique, not just in our industry, but certainly in the co-op sector as well.
And that is one thing that I did pick up from the website, is it's very much about that education, is that there is no one true expert. So
yeah,
the diversity of life experiences and everything like that definitely adds.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, even, you know, around things that aren't about sexuality, you know, our experiences are extraordinarily subjective and extraordinarily individual. And when we see those individual experiences and how they fold into people's sexualities, you know, there's just not a lot of room for you to be able to make assumptions about people's sexualities. In fact, we find that assumptions are dangerous. You know, whenever you assume that a person has a particular sexuality, orientation, gender, based on, you know, whatever trivial information you have about them, you know, you risk putting them in that box. And when we're doing customer service with folks and helping them try to figure out either their sexual trajectory or even just, you know, what lubricant to use, you know, as soon as you start making assumptions about, you know, what kind of sex that person is having or who they're having sex with or what sex even means to them, it means that you're more likely to push them in the direction of a particular product or a particular, you know, resource or whatever else. Whereas when you leave the slate truly blank, and you allow the person to really determine, okay, what is my sexual trajectory? What do I need? You just give them all of the information from a really sort of unloaded place. And and the rest just kind of follows. So I think that, you know, in terms of our founding, you know, being founded as a co-op, again, you know, really helped us reflect a diverse set of experiences. But, you know, it also took the profit incentive out of the transaction. So, you know, we've never had, our staff have never made commission. You know, we've very rarely had profit sharing, if any. And the idea was really that, you know, when you look at traditional sex shops, the stuff that they market or they carry is the stuff that they're making the most margin on, right? It's not, they're not good sex toys. They're not good products. It's just whatever they can make the most cash off of. So for us, you know, we really took the money part out of it to really keep those customer interactions pure.
And in terms of the education towards the clientele, once you've got them in the door, how do you educate your clientele who may be unsure of or unaware of where their sexuality might lie?
Well, I think, you know, again, it really comes down to treating all people reasonably equally. You know, we greet people, I mean, the same way you do in any, you know, any kind of shop. And we really just offer help. And then we let their people's like questions or concerns guide the rest of the conversation. So, I mean, the education piece for us happens in a few different ways. One is that we're extraordinarily informed about the products we carry and the materials that sex toys are made of, all that really important stuff. We've always offered workshops, so it's a more of a private setting where people can learn about very specific sex topics. We carry a huge number of educational books and also educational DVDs. So, you know, we're about education, but, you know, it's more that we're not about selling. We've never seen ourselves as salespeople. We just are like, you know, we go through, we pick out the best of the best stuff. We find a way to carry good things at reasonable prices. And again, you know, being a co-op has a lot to do with that because we don't have, you know, a third party boss or a venture capitalist or a bunch of investors who need to pull profit from the company. So it means that we can really have fair prices. And we're really just here to present, you know, just a ton of resources for anyone who wants to take us up on that. So, you know, the education part, like, do we do sexual education? Sort of, but mostly it's really just being informed about the things we carry and the possibilities that people, you know, might want to pursue.
So it's a lot of driving business via the quality of your product and your services.
Oh, entirely, yeah.
Prior to closing the storefront in August. How long was the shop on Queen Street West?
For 19 years.
So has the development on Queen Street over the years become less conducive to the cooperative or small business models?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that Queen Street West used to be sort of an up-and-coming, pre-gentrified area where most of the businesses were fabric stores. And we moved in at 701 Queen West in 97 when there was, you know, no walk-by, there was no American Apparel, there was kind of nothing down there. And it was us and some really great record stores and video stores and independent clothing stores. And, you know, truth be told, they're all gone. We were sort of the last ones hanging on. So when you look at Queen Street West, it's decidedly unfriendly to small business and certainly to anti-capitalist businesses like our own. So, you know, Toronto's changing. I think that this is the first time in my life that I've really gotten a sense that Toronto really doesn't want us. You know, I mean, Toronto really wants, you know, big moneyed capitalism. And if you're not that, you're really getting pushed aside. And I think, you know, we're seeing this in every major center. Vancouver has a lot of the same issues. Certainly, you know, London and San Francisco have the same issues times a million. So, you know, it's a transition period for large cities, and we'll see what happens with it. For us, you know, our rent just went up to, I think, $12,000 a month. And every space that we looked at, we got outbid by a dispensary. So we just made the decision, you know, because the store itself technically had been losing money for a long, long time. And most of our, you know, the thing that was keeping us in business was our website, which we've been online since 1998. So we're really just taking a hiatus from bricks and mortar while we figure out what we want to do next. And it's depressing for Toronto because I think that people really depend on us as a resource and still do. But at the same time, it's really exciting. Like, you know, for the first time in our co-op's history, to look and be like, you know, what do we want to do next? You know, the last 20 years, it's all been like, what do we have to do next to survive? You know, what do we have to do? You know, we have to open the store tomorrow. You know, we have to do whatever advertising. We've got to, you know, raise funds for whatever projects. And right now it's like, wow, you know, we actually get to have a bit of self-determination, which I know sounds ironic for a co-op because it should all be self-determination. But, you know, the realities of having a retail store and having staff and that day to day, it doesn't leave a lot of room for, you know, the possibility of something else. So, I mean, we're pretty excited about it. And already, like, we're able to do things that we weren't able to do before. So, you know, coming up, we're doing the Erotic Arts and Crafts Fair at the Gladstone Hotel here in Toronto. We're doing more outreach. We're doing more markets. And, yeah, we'll see what comes. But, you know, it's a really privileging sort of place to be in right now.
Do you think there are any, like, developing communities in the Toronto area that might be a good fit? Or is this... Do you think that it's going to be basically online only from here on out?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, for us, you know, we were caught off guard by how busy we were over the sort of Christmas type holidays. We really thought we would have this very leisurely fall to, you know, look at places and come up with a visioning and figure out some steps forward. But we have just been, just overwhelmed by the amount of traffic and sales that we've been doing from the website and also from, you know, fairs and things that we've been doing in person. So we've decided as a group that we are going to hold off on making any firm plans until, at least until Valentine's is over. So probably sort of, you know, end of fiscal year, I think we'll sit down and do some visioning and try to figure out what's next. You know, it's funny because, I mean, there are some pockets in Toronto that are really nice, but they tend to be, they're very specific communities. So, you know, we could move to the West End, but I feel like, you know, it's not quite the sort of DIY, you know, anarchist queer sort of vibe that we're going for. I mean, the East End is sort of similar. There's some folks who really want us to move to Hamilton, which is, you know, just a little bit outside of Toronto. And I have to say we're tempted. There's some folks starting a petition to get us to move to Peterborough, again, a little bit outside of Toronto. So I don't know. I mean, we'll see what happens. But, you know, I think that if we had the will for it and if all the folks are on board, I mean, we could open multiple stores. The future is really exciting and it's nice to be approaching it from a position of power because we really haven't before.
How do you feel that the public perception towards sexuality has progressed over, we'll say 20 years since the co-op's been open for that period of time?
That's a hard question to answer. I am tempted to say, I mean, the temptation is always to say that progress has meant that we are all much more open-minded and better educated. I'm not sure it's true, though. When I look at the last 20 years, I don't actually sense a huge change in the discourse around sexuality. When I look back 40 years, so if we look back to sort of the 1970s, 1980s, you know, when you look at the stuff that they were doing in, you know, San Francisco, Montreal in 1975 around sexuality, I mean, it was a much more progressive time. And in fact, the gains that we made as a society over the last 40 years were largely erased by Ronald Reagan and the HIV crisis. And I think that we've been slowly building back, you know, to where we were 40 years ago. But it is a long haul. I think that we've, you know, we're seeing legal rights, things around marriage for gay and lesbian folks. We're seeing more trans rights, although barely. So I don't know. I mean, in some ways, I'm pretty disheartened about the sort of the future of our society. When, you know, if we look at even, you know, Trump getting elected in the States, I mean, I have to say that the kind of discourse is definitely a step backward. You know, the exciting thing, though, is that when culture does get more conservative, which I do feel in my heart that it is becoming more conservative, when culture becomes more conservative, we find better and more interesting ways to resist. And so I anticipate that, like we saw in the 80s, I think that under Trump and under this sort of new regime of weird right-wing conservative of discourse, we're going to see some amazing art, when we're going to see some amazing people engage in new kinds of resistance that we've never seen before. So do I think that things have progressed in a positive way in the last 20 years? I'm not sure they have. I think that legal standings for some groups have gotten better, but on the whole, I don't feel like people are more open around their sexualities. I don't feel like people, you know, are exploring things in a way that was way different than 20 years ago. But, you know, that's just my take, and it's from a very, very unique position.
That's still a good position, though. That is an excellent insight into the progression over the
last... It's so depressing.
That's the thing, though, is that it's like you were saying about the art, which raises a really good point, that... There are ways, like art always subverts conservative attitudes in almost every instance.
Yeah.
And this could be a very good opportunity.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, for us, like we really felt in the 90s, like when this co-op was founded, and I'm not a founding member, but I'm about the same age as the founding members. Like, you know, I'm in the same generation. And it did feel like we were on the brink of something, you know, it really felt like, you know, we're aiming towards a much less sexually conservative society. It felt like we're heading towards a more secular society. And I just feel like, yeah, those things have not materialized. And I think that, you know, the left largely got distracted. I think that it felt like things were going well and folks were really happy to buy into this weird neoliberal, you know, philosophy. But yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see. I think that in some ways, you know, we one of our core values is to be the anti-experts, and which is really hard because people are always looking to us to be experts. Like we should know everything about sexuality and everything about sex products. And we really feel in our heart of hearts that, you know more about your sexuality and what you need and what you want than we could ever possibly know. And I think in some ways that this post-truth era, we are extraordinarily well-suited for it because we never thought there was a truth in the first place, right? So, you know, I think it'll be really interesting to see what comes next. It's really, really scary. You know, we do find in some ways that, you know, the more corporate everything gets around us, the more we're able to find these people who are looking for something else. And, you know, I think that when, you know, the whole society goes big, you get all of the people who really do care, who want, you know, who want to know what those locally made products are, who want things that are environmentally responsible, who want things that are good for their bodies, you know, who want things that aren't full of misogynist packaging and marketing. And, you know, that's really exciting. It's sad that it does seem to be sort of a fairly privileged position, that is, people who have a fair bit of privilege are the ones who are able to seek these things out and obtain them. But, you know, I think we've also always had a commitment to making things economically accessible, you know, for everyone. So, you know, it's exciting and it's depressing all at the same time, but I guess that's what life is.
And there's also a nice balance between the sort of like the gentrification of an area like Queen Street West and the rise of the internet, because you're not going to see people who are unfortunately, you're not going to see as many people looking for those community values or those locally owned shops or those co-ops for brick and mortar, because that just feels like it's going the way of the big box stores. But the internet has just become this absolutely amazing place where you can connect with like-minded individuals and people who have this inherent sort of desire for quality in education. And you can get that discourse like through your website or if they're local, you can be promoting local events and things like that.
Well, yeah, exactly. And, you know, as a co-op that has always done a lot of work in disability communities, we always really prioritized making our storefront accessible. So we installed the automatic door mechanism ourselves. And, you know, we had a friend of ours install the accessible washroom. We did all these really tangible things. But, you know, the reality is you want to connect with people who have disabilities. That's online. You know, if you want to talk about making information more accessible to people with disabilities, again, that is online, because something that is accessible through a computer is much easier to access than, you know, than using, you know, accessible transit to get downtown, to waiting for Wheel-Trans, like, you know, whatever the thing is. It's interesting that we've really actually been able to reduce barriers by being more present on the web. And that's been a really exciting development over the last 10 years, for sure.
And even things like operational hours, don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, exactly. And even now, you know, because we're not down to the store, you know, all day, every day for whatever 12 hours a day, it means that we can do things like answer emails on our off hours, and we can be a lot more responsive to queries that people have on Twitter or on Facebook. So that's a really exciting way to do customer service as well.
Have you guys considered, or have you done any like online like webinars or anything like that?
Yeah, we've considered it. I mean, I think that for us, we are we're somewhat opposed to video. I think in the world of we've never been focused on individuals. We've never been focused on us as people. We've never wanted to be sort of web celebrities or in real life celebrities. And we feel strongly that video representation of bodies by default excludes the possibility of other forms of representation. So, even if we have the most diverse staff in the world, to have someone up on a screen telling you about sex toys, it really says something about the person. It implies something about the person who might use those sex toys. And for us, we want to be as blank a slate as possible. So we have a ton of information online, certainly in written form, but we don't do much in the way of webinars.
I completely appreciate and respect the fact that you will strive not to create this, any sort of sexual preconception or anything along those lines. I think an absolute rarity, even amongst the more, like you said earlier, is that a lot of sex positive shops that open up tend to have a very specific mandate, or they have an individual who owns them who has a very specific idea of what they're promoting. And to eliminate that via the cooperative narrative, and well, just eliminate that via being decent as well as the cooperative narrative.
You know, as much as sleazy sex shops are terrible and are horrible for people's sexuality, one well-intentioned but misinformed, you know, sexpert will do more to ruin your sexuality for life than 1,000 terrible sex shops will. It's such a peculiar phenomenon. I mean, I think at this point, you know, we even have issues with the concept of sex positivity. As much as we get lumped in as a sex positive sex shop, we sort of can't stand it as a concept or as a community. It's become a whole other means to judge people's sexualities. It's peculiar. But I think this was what happens with every category and every movement is that, you know, while it may have been really useful in the 1980s to counter sex negative feminism with sex positive feminism, I don't know if you know much about the lesbian sex wars of the 1980s, otherwise known as the feminist porn wars of the 1980s. So I think sex positive feminism was really helpful at that juncture because it was about women, you know, embracing and articulating a need to have control over their sexualities, over the porn they were making, around BDSM, really important stuff. But you know what? It's like it's 2017, and it's not even a sex-negative feminism anymore. It's just a sex-negative culture. So I think the battle is different, and I think the words we need to start using are different too. But and we're at a real crux. You know, things are actually changing. When you look at, say, the feminist porn landscape, it sort of blossomed there for a good 10 years, but it's kind of shriveled again. So, you know, what will come to take its place? But that's the other thing about our culture right now is it is so rapidly changing that, you know, who knows what's around the corner. It could be anything.
And it's the when you were touching upon like the damage that could be done by one sort of misplaced ideal or one pushed ideal, yeah, is trust. Yeah. Trust is definitely plays a big part into it. Like you talk to one of those sleazy sex shops, you know what it is. there is a very, very low level of trust.
Yeah.
And then you turn that around and you have someone who's on the absolute opposite end of the spectrum,
mm-hmm.
who kind of has that trust because they're like, now that you've said it, I don't want to say sex positive, but
okay.
because they're sort of, you can lump them in that section.
Yeah.
They have that sort of inherent trust value, and that's where they can really do the damage by pushing a specific agenda or lumping you in with a specific, labeling you with something very specific.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, as people who really care about what we do, whenever members of our co-op travel at all, we go into every sex shop in every town that we are in just to, you know, see what people have going on. And I'll tell you, like, I've been fed more misinformation at, you know, feminist sex positive sex shops than I ever have been at a sleazy sex shop. At a sleazy sex shop, if you ask a question, like, you know, where was this made, whatever, they'll just be like, I don't know. You know, like, they don't care. But in feminist sex shops, you know, it's really interesting that people will just be like, oh, this is made in France. And it's like, it's not. It's made in China. Like, you know, it's, I know it has a French name, I know whatever, but, you know, it's so interesting that, you know, despite the sort of care and the training, whatever, that, you know, misinformation is, I mean, there's almost nothing but misinformation about sexuality. And I think it's, I mean, like I said, I think we're really prepared for this post-truth world because we really don't believe that there is a fundamental central truth to anyone's sexuality or gender or orientation, you know? We don't think anyone's right. I think that it's just a matter of, you know, finding a path that kind of works for you. And I think, you know, it's kind of like food a bit, you know? Like, there's no right, like, there's no right thing to eat. Like, I think, you know, humans have been on this earth for, you know, millions of years in some sort of evolutionary form. And, like, we don't know how what to feed our dogs, you know, or how to breed dogs. Like, I just don't think that we really know all that much about anything. And while that might be unsettling to deal with a co-op, sex shop co-op that believes that there is no fundamental truth, it's extraordinarily liberating at the same time.
Oh, it's that that when you believe in nothing, you are free to do anything.
Yeah, exactly.
I was going to ask what the vetting process for products is like, because there is a lot of lower quality products out there. There's a lot of potentially harmful products and things that are out there that come really cheap and ergo get promoted, like you're saying earlier. You know, profit driven ventures are always going to be aiming to cut those sort of costs, but that also means that on the production side, businesses are like producers are going to go down that road. So how do you find the people who don't act like that?
Yeah, you know, I think that one of the great things about the 1990s was that it was this moment in time where a lot of people who cared deeply about sexuality and sex products resisted by literally just making their own. So, like, a lot of the companies that make really high quality silicone toys, toys that are body safe, a lot of those companies started as cottage industries in the 90s. So they were literally like pouring silicone dildos in their kitchen. You know, we'd get packages in and they'd have cat hairs in them because, you know, it was just someone's apartment that they were making these toys. And so a lot of those companies have stuck around. And so we're still able to deal with them. And then there's a lot of companies that were inspired, I think, probably in sort of the mid-2000s to launch high quality, sort of more luxury brands. And so they tend to use the same sort of high quality materials and typically more things like vibrators and massagers. They tend to be quite expensive. So the cool thing is, though, is that when a lot of these cottage industry companies got big in the subsequent 10 or 20 years that they existed, they opened these niches for, now we're seeing this really great evolution where tiny companies are making silicone toys like in their kitchens again. So you've got all these really neat producers. So you've got, you know, like I said, folks have been around for like 20, 30 years doing what they do, but they've become really big companies. And so it's opened up these opportunities for people who want to do really custom handmade stuff. So that's really neat. And then our vetting process is just that we just try stuff. You know, we vet people's silicone because like everything in this world, you know, you can go and buy a silicone sex toy that isn't actually made of silicone. I think the law is that you have to have 10% silicone to call a toy a silicone toy. So for us, you know, the first thing is to weed out all those companies that lie about their ingredients. The second thing is to actually use the product to make sure it does everything they're supposed to do. And then I think, you know, in the future, we're looking at adding a lot more information to our website. So already we have things like vibrator ratings and, you know, how loud toys are and what they're made of. But I'd like to start doing more, which is to actually indicate, you know, when products are made in a fair wage environment. Because for me as a consumer, that actually is extraordinarily important to me. And so I can only assume for the people who follow us that that would be valuable information to have. And then, you know, even the sleazy old school sex companies, like the folks who, you know, the Doc Johnsons or the Cal Exotics or the Topcos of the world, you know, they make some really terrible toys, but often they're really inexpensive toys are perfectly body safe and wonderful to use. So, you know, it's a lot of work because there's a lot of product on the market, but we've been doing it so long that we really have a good lay of the land, and we know who's who, and we know who makes great stuff at a high price, and we know who makes great stuff at a low price. The other thing is that I think that a lot of the conversation around the toxicity of sex toys has been a fair bit overblown. I think that as much as we do want to avoid things like parabens and phthalates in all of the products in our lives, you know, the reality is that most people aren't using sex toys so frequently or so constantly that those materials are going to cause a lot of health problems. There's some exceptions to that, but by and large, I think it's great to focus on non-toxic, non-porous sex toys. But let's also not forget that, you know, in fact, a lot of the cheap ones are amazing as well. Phew.
I got nothing. I kind of thought that was awesome.
Yeah, I mean, like, so this is the thing around, like, you know, hard plastic vibrators that they, you know, used to sell in the 1970s, and they had, like, you know, 2C batteries and whatever else. You know, those toys are still great sex toys. You know, so it's a lot of process, and we definitely have much higher costs associated with running our business this way. So, you know, every time we bring in a new product, we have to, you know, write off one of them to try, and we write off another as a sample so customers can check it out. So, it's, you know, if we're even going to consider a product, we have to be pretty sure that we want to pick it up, because otherwise it just costs so much for us to pick up anything that it just makes us approach it with more seriousness.
And it also makes you more educated at the end of the day about it. If someone comes in and asks you about something, you can actually answer where it was made and the little nuances of the product.
Oh, absolutely.
We've talked a lot about the website today, and it is www.comeasyouare.com.
That's correct.
I've been poking around the website for the last couple of weeks, and it is an absolute wealth of information.
Yes, and we're in the process of migrating it, so it'll be much more organized and up-to-date wealth of information very soon.
Migrating it to another host?
Yeah. I think our site is a custom site we built probably a decade ago and have kept it updated since then. But I think it's time for a refresher, which is also, again, very exciting. And if we had the store right now, I don't know that we'd be able to scope out the time to do that. So, yeah, a lot of changes. And, you know, it's been a really weird year and we really miss the bricks and mortar. But, you know, like I said, it's really empowering to be able to go into this next phase of our co-op's existence, you know, with a little bit of autonomy and say over what we do next.
All right. So, as you know, today is Valentine's Day. That's when the show is airing. And for everyone listening in, this was recorded a little bit earlier than that. There's a lot of expectation and a lot of, I don't know, it seems almost like a lot of grandeur around certain aspects of Valentine's Day. Do you care to throw in your opinion on the subject or your idea of Valentine's Day?
Yeah, Valentine's is hard. Valentine's Day is difficult because it is in some ways, you know, the archetype of the invented capitalist holiday. And so as an anti-capitalist co-op, you know, we would really like to stand in opposition to Valentine's Day. But at the same time, you know, it's really special in the world of holidays. And the fact that it's not, you know, an official sort of stat holiday is a bit disappointing. Because, you know, it is sort of the only time of year that we celebrate love at all, with the possible exception of Family Day here in Ontario. But, you know, I think it's terribly romantic that we do have a day on the calendar that is set aside to celebrate love in its many forms. And so, you know, I'd urge people, you know, don't buy into the, you know, expensive gifts or the Hallmark card or whatever else. But it is a really wonderful opportunity to reconnect with yourself or with your lover or with your lovers. And I think we should all take a tip from, you know, I don't know if you've read this thing about how millennials supposedly value experiences over objects. And, Yeah, and I think that we could also take a bit of a tip from that, which is that, you know, instead of buying things for Valentine's, to have, you know, some intentionality around setting up an experience that celebrates your love or your lust, or your desire to snuggle even. So, you know, I think grand gestures, it's not really my scene. And again, as an anti-capitalist co-op, we're really loath to suggest that people buy things. But, you know, it can be a really fun time to, you know, experience something with your lover or with yourself and to set aside a little special time. So, I mean, you know, we're a little burnt out in Valentine's here. We've been doing it for 20 years as a sex shop co-op. But as a concept, you know, we're right behind it.
I always just imagine that there's a little bit of a pop in business right around that time of year, which is a good thing for the bottom line. But like you said, it's, you know, it's more of a, as long as it's not done in the back of like a grand gesture because you feel like you have to, as opposed to celebrating the actual relationship.
Yeah, and we've always loved to see, you know, people who, you know, go out to a sex shop together on Valentine's. Like, rather than, I think that, you know, sex toys are really hard gifts to buy. You know, the sizing alone is difficult to figure out. But, you know, sex toys are so individual that even if you've been with them for a long time, it's really hard to know what they will find aesthetically pleasing or functional in their lives. So we always encourage folks to, you know, do something together. And if you do want to buy something, to go out and buy it together, because I think that can be a really cute, romantic, and reconnecting experience. But yeah, the hollow, you know, box of chocolates and roses, I mean, whatever, I'll never say no to a box of chocolates. But, you know, that sort of high-pressure commercial capitalist thing, yeah, no, forget that. But, you know, maybe take some time and figure out a way that you can authentically reconnect to yourself or to your lovers, you know?
Do you find that a lot of the people who come into the shop, like, do you get a lot of couples or individuals? Like, what's the usual clientele like?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we don't collect demographic information on principle. But anecdotally, I think one of the cool things about our store is that literally every single person who interacts with our store infers that our store is for them. So like I've listened to people who walk by our store who will be like, oh yeah, that's the feminist sex shop. Oh yeah, no, that's the lesbian sex shop. Oh no, that's the feminist sex shop for couples or the feminist sex shop for guys or whatever. Oh, that's the place where trans people go. So people really have it in their minds that we are a sex shop for whatever category they loosely find themselves in. And I've always loved that. I mean, because it's hard to market a business that sort of has this, you know, identity that is all over the map. But it's really neat that people have always been able to see themselves in our store. So, I mean, in terms of who comes into our store, I'd say that it literally is all over the map. Like we have, you know, women in their 80s who have been using olive oil for lube for a million years and are wondering if there's something commercially available that would be better. You know, we have couples who are like, you know, right out of high school who are, you know, looking to kind of like figure out sex toys together and who are really interested in, you know, orgasms for everyone in the relationship. So really all over the map. But definitely, I think that when you look at other feminist sex shops, like we have like a higher proportion of cisgender men who shop in our store compared to most feminist sex shops. And I think that's because we've always had folks who are male identified on staff or as worker owners. And we were one of the few sex shops founded in a feminist sort of spectrum that was founded by someone who was male identified, which is hugely, hugely unusual for this industry. So yeah, I would say it's all over the map. Our customers are kind of everybody.
Thank you very, very, very much for taking the time to talk to me today. I feel like it's been very eye-opening and very, very informative.
Yeah, it's been an absolute blast being on your show. Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I would like to thank Jack Lehman from Come As You Are for talking to me a couple of days ago. Their co-op website is www.comeasyouare.com. That's spelled with an O for anyone who is punny out there. That's all from us tonight. We'll have the show up on our website, which is eachforall.coop. On behalf of Robin Puga, Dale McGladdery, Kevin Olnick, Sandy Goldman, I'm Joshua Peterman, joined in studio by Paul McDonald. Thank you for listening, and let us play you out.